It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The U.S. Department of Education has decided against offering a waiver in standardized testing requirements this year. Some educators wanted the Biden administration to cancel the tests for this school year. The department did give states the option to administer these annual tests over the summer or even in the fall. Chris Lilienthal is with the Pennsylvania State Education Association, PSEA. It's the largest teachers union in the state. Welcome, Chris.
Glad to be with you.
Chris, the tests are intended to measure achievement in key subjects, including math and reading. In January, your union asked federal officials to cancel the requirement for the tests. Why?
It's a very unusual school year. I don't need to tell you or your listeners that. Many school districts across the Commonwealth are in either remote instruction or in a hybrid instructional model. And as a result, we have seen some students struggling in those environments. And this has been a deep concern for our educators and our support staff. They very much want to be back in the classroom with their students. Of course, we're in the midst of a pandemic and we have to take safety measures. So our big concern, our number one concern really was, we want to focus on what the students need. And we felt that taking several weeks out of the remainder of this school year to conduct standardized testing would cause students to lose just too much classroom instructional time in a year when they've already lost too much time.
You didn't get the waiver, but you did get wiggle room. The State Department of Education has extended the annual testing window through September, giving school districts more time to meet the requirements. So a partial victory from your point?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, certainly while we clearly would have preferred to have a federal waiver of the annual assessments, just as we did last year, PSA was very pleased with the decision by the Pennsylvania Department of Education to give school districts that needed time and flexibility.
A reminder, the federal government suspended the testing requirement last spring. That means public school students haven't taken state standardized tests in nearly 2 years. Many teachers have told WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider, without standardized testing, we'll never know how much students lost who were home for most of the year compared to those who might have been in person in a hybrid setting. Are you concerned that our schools, our educators, our administrators might not have a good sense of how the students are progressing?
First of all, I would say that if we truly want our schools and educators to focus on learning recovery, addressing the gaps that are that students have right now, we shouldn't be administering standardized testing that's going to take them out of the classroom time even more. The other point that I think is important to remember is that teachers know where their students have slipped. And I think we need to trust them as the professionals that they are to be able to do their jobs well. And when we can move past this pandemic, to be able to come back and address those learning gaps and make sure that students are making the progress that they need to be successful.
Okay, you've emphasized a couple times now the taking up of time. So with this sort of window that has been given so that the standardized test can be administered, but over a longer period of time. Do you support the idea of doing it maybe in the summertime so that you can have a good grasp going into the next school year?
We would certainly be supportive of conducting these tests in summer, in early September, whenever the districts feel that they can accomplish it in the safest way possible. Because as I mentioned, there are logistic concerns there too, particularly if you're a district that's been in hybrid mode and you haven't had all of your students in the building at once, and just making sure that you can accommodate that and that we're in a place whenever it would be in the summer that can happen safely. But yeah, that would certainly be one way that we could do this and still accomplish this goal without having to detract from further classroom time.
So Chris, the results of standardized exams can be used to evaluate schools and sometimes teachers. Was that a concern at all during this school year and regarding whether we'd have standardized tests this time around or not?
It was absolutely a concern. Standardized tests were never designed to be valid or reliable measures of what a student knows from our perspective or are able to do. There are a variety of other ways that we can assess what students have learned and what they know and what they're able to do. They're especially unreliable now when we know that these tests cannot be administered with any consistency given the safety measures. So we feel very strongly that that would have been a concern, and we would not have supported using these test results here in Pennsylvania or anywhere else for educator evaluations in this very unusual year.
And that was not a concern because of state legislation in this particular year?
That's correct. Yeah. Earlier in the fall, the state legislature passed a comprehensive school code bill that included some measures specifically addressing the pandemic. And one of those was that student test results for 2020-21 school year would not apply to teacher evaluations. Just in this current school year, evaluations would be focused on teacher observations and professional practice.
Chris Lilienthal is with the Pennsylvania State Education Association. Chris, thanks for your time.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Earlier this month, a 24-year-old transgender woman was killed in New Wilmington, Lawrence County. Her name is China Carrillo, and she's the first known trans person murdered in Pennsylvania this year. Violence against transgender people has risen over the years to a level the Pennsylvania Youth Congress has called epidemic. Preston Heldebreitel is the state policy associate with the Pennsylvania Youth Congress. It's an LGBTQ youth advocacy organization. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me.
Preston, what tells you that violence against the transgender community is an epidemic?
First off, just the numbers we've been seeing the past couple years are staggering. In 2020, at least 44 transgender Americans were killed. And the last 2 months alone of 2021, we already have 7 trans people confirmed killed this year. And these are only the confirmed cases. Many times these incidents go underreported because of the lack of comprehensive ID system. Perhaps the levels are higher. The police simply don't know that the victims are transgender.
Many states don't have that comprehensive ID system, correct?
Exactly. It's a complicated, time-consuming process, and many trans people don't go through it for years.
China's killing is the first this year in Pennsylvania, as I said. How are you and other folks in your organization feeling right now?
We're feeling sad and disheartened. Violence against trans people in Pennsylvania continues to happen. We see about 1 to 2 murders every year in Pennsylvania, and mostly of Black and brown trans women. It needs to stop.
Yes, 24, just very near her 25th birthday, I believe. Authorities have indicated they don't believe this murder is a hate crime, but what protections are there for those in the trans and the broader LGBTQ community against hate crimes?
As of now, we don't have any hate crimes protections. We once had hate crimes protections. It was passed in 2002. It was the first LGBT-specific law in the country, passed by Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican Governor. That was repealed in 2008 due to a technicality, but that had widespread bipartisan support when it was passed, and we don't have non-discrimination protections either.
Pennsylvania, one of 13 states that doesn't have sexual orientation or gender identity as protected against hate crimes. Why do you think it didn't get passed again if it had broad support the first time?
I think that LGBT issues have been turned into partisan football. These are human rights issues. These are people's lives on the line. It needs to be treated as such.
How does someone's status as transgender put them at risk of being a victim for violence, do you feel?
Well, certainly the problem is not only outright transphobia. While clear-cut transphobic attitudes often absolutely play a role, trans women of color are so much more likely to face violence due to the circumstances they're likely to be living under at the intersections of not only transphobia, but homophobia, racism, wealth inequality, and so on. So while we desperately need LGBTQ specific protections against violence and discrimination, we also desperately need access to affordable housing, healthcare, education, and well-paying jobs, because that is what's essential to creating safe communities. So it's really, you know, all the intersections of identity compounding to create this heightened risk.
Preston, last October, you and other members of the Pennsylvania Youth Congress testified at the State Senate Majority Policy Committee on Hate Crimes Protections. It was the first time, I understand, that LGBTQ advocates have been invited to address a Republican policy committee. What was that like?
It was a very heartening day. Our executive director, Jason Goodman, and fellow activist Kendall Stevens spoke at the hearing, and Kendall Stevens telling her story of when she was violently attacked and what hate crimes protections would mean for her and people like her. You could see it have a visible effect on the senators in the room.
Up for discussion was Senate Bill 44, which would expand the protected statutes against hate crimes. So can you give us an idea where that bill is right now?
We'll be seeing how it plays out as the session days come out, but so far I haven't heard much about it advancing yet, but we are absolutely hoping for it to go forward.
Earlier, you talked a little bit about the need for affordable housing for the trans community. What more do you want to see done by the state and federal governments to support and protect the LGBTQ community?
These are budget issues. Access to health care, affordable housing, these are things that need to be prioritized in the budget. The budget for this year has already pretty much been hammered out. Going forward, these need to be priority areas, and legislators need to be putting pressure on the governor to make these areas priority, because they're essential for keeping our communities safe.
So employment, economic mobility, they play into solving the problem of violence. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Intercommunity violence has always been exacerbated by conditions of poverty. And so if we lift those conditions of poverty, rates of violence go down because people have what they need to survive. They don't need to engage in survival crimes, and there's not as much stress in daily life, which can lead to outbursts, especially if people can't access mental health services.
You mentioned the support that you're hoping for from state lawmakers. For listeners who are straight or don't identify as LGBTQ, what do you hope that they can bring to the table to support the community?
We just need to be treated and protected as all of our peers are. You know, no one should ever be attacked simply for their identity. Spreading that message and holding people accountable to that, you know, very reasonable norm is what we need. We need people to, you know, stand with us.
Preston Heldebreitel is the State Policy Associate with the Pennsylvania Youth Congress. Preston, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When Aisha Scott wrote her PhD dissertation on the effects of the AIDS epidemic on Black Americans 2 years ago, she warned that even if a cure for the disease were found tomorrow, quote, a new disease would emerge wreaking the same havoc on the African American community. A year into the coronavirus pandemic, this virus has proven twice as deadly for Black Americans than for whites. 90.5 WESA Sarah Bowden spoke with Scott, now a postdoctoral fellow in history at Carnegie Mellon University, about the parallels between COVID-19 and HIV/AIDS, including housing insecurity, for which Black Americans are at greater risk, and that puts a person at greater risk of contracting either virus.
With COVID, it's sort of straightforward. Having a safe and stable place to live allows a person to isolate from others who might be infected with this respiratory virus. With HIV, the patterns of transmission are very different because the virus is spread through certain bodily fluids like blood or semen. So how does housing insecurity increase someone's chances of contracting HIV?
Thank you so much for this question, because it's multi-layered. One, that people who have housing, one will have more connections to care, right? They are going to be able to go to a pharmacy and have a regular space to fill prescriptions. They're more likely to have regular doctors that they can go to. That so one, if someone does become infected, they're able to get connected to care. And we now know that people who are connected to care and have are able to get their levels to undetectable are not transmitting HIV when they have intercourse. So that's one way. Another way is that people who have housing instability are often in spaces in their relationships where they're not able to advocate for themselves in the same way. If it's someone's in a domestically abusive situation, they don't feel that they can necessarily tell their partner, I'm not comfortable with the idea of having unprotected sex because I don't know when was the last time you were tested, or I want you to get tested. And also the fear that if they're not in a space where they can be autonomous on their own in terms of financial security, that they don't want to be put out on the street. So this shows the connections to housing stability and in terms of employment security as well, having adequate, making a living wage and being able to support yourself and not be in a dependent situation in that way.
You mentioned employment, and people who work outside the home are at higher risk for contracting the coronavirus. Many of these jobs are low-wage positions. Are there similar patterns between employment and HIV?
Most definitely, the higher the poverty level, the higher the HIV infection rate. When we think about homelessness, or you think about housing insecurity, you're thinking about people living in poverty and with the most extreme forms of poverty. So it makes sense that people who are lower income are having higher infection rates. People not having access to living wages and to jobs that provide them with adequate living arrangements, connections to healthcare, having jobs that don't necessarily automatically qualify you for healthcare or great healthcare. You're only able to do the bare minimum, or it's just not financially feasible. You're making decisions as to whether or not you go to a doctor or you're buying food. This puts people in a different dynamic.
I keep going back to the idea that the coronavirus and HIV, they're just such different viruses, but the things that make people more vulnerable to these viruses are so similar.
This is how we see the hierarchy of socioeconomic status impacting health outcomes. And that's really the larger picture here, that we're not just talking about these diseases. And I feel like that's what happens, and that's the misstep that happens every time there's some sort of disease outbreak. Like, it's that we talk about the disease, but we don't talk about the systemic issues that leave marginalized communities vulnerable. And we don't talk about them with intention because it's expensive to fix them.
Carnegie Mellon postdoctoral fellow Aisha Scott speaking with WESA's Sarah Bowden. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.